Blog Talk Radio.
Gillian Wright with Dr. Bowles. Good afternoon. It's so good of you to join me. As you see, the topic today is scientific proof that you can make me sick. I have been talking to those of you who are following the show about self-inspection, introspection, and we've talked about a number of things on how to get your life uncluttered and get on the right track, as you may say, the concept of law of attraction, how to bring good things to you, and if you have experienced what you would call bad luck, how to recover from it and reproject and rearrange situations so that that luck, in effect, could change. Well, in that vein, I've been doing a lot of reading and studying, and as you may or may not know, my basic training was in biochemistry, at least the research side, so I'm always fascinated with how the body works, bio being life, chemistry meaning the function of life or the composition of elements in life. So biochemistry has fascinated me, interests me, and when someone can explain what is otherwise intangible in terms of something scientific, I find that absolutely wonderful. And I was reading something recently, and they started making correlation. There is a female researcher who has exerted herself in what we call the neurobiology, studying the brain. She's studying receptors. And what she's finding is no new news to the everyday basic person, because we have all kinds of statements in our vocabulary that prove that most of us believe that our emotion governs how we feel. We have terms like love sick, heart sick. When we're frustrated and just totally disappointed in someone, we can say, "You make me sick." I have seen people grieve, and they make comments like, "I was worried sick." Well, these terms sound sometimes over the top. And some groups, some cultural groups, are more in tune with those types of causes of illness, that if you look at traditional medicines, and what I mean by that, that would be in the Native American cultures, it would be in the African or Black American cultures. I've seen it in most basic cultures, even in the very poor and rural setting throughout the Western world, there is a type of mother wit where you will always get the reference of keep her happy or make her happy and she will stay well. In the Navajo tradition, I learned when I was there in Tuba City a number of years ago that a pregnant woman is said to start a beautiful walk. And with this thinking, many times the women in the village or in the area, particularly her female relatives, will come to her. And the whole idea is to create joy and beauty and music and love. And this is a very special time for both the male and female. I learned a lot watching the traditions of the announcement of a pregnancy and how the entire community adjusted their behaviors to accommodate the beautiful walk. True. And now we're getting scientific proof that how you feel emotionally can affect how you feel physically. Okay, for some of you skeptics, okay, plug in the holes, how is this even possible? Let me walk through for you a little biochemistry that research in the brain has shown that there are actually receptors, and we're calling those psychoneuroimmunology, a real big mouthful, where the core idea is that the cells in the brain are lined with receptors and that these receptors constantly share information. Now, let me step back and come out of the laboratory and give it to you in layman terms. Those of you who during the 60s and 70s and 80s were in the movement of psychedelic love and stimulants, then marijuana was a big drug of choice because of the compound THC created a sense of well-being and love and giving the roses what make love and not war. Certainly was used by a lot of people who said it was their recreational relaxation drug of choice. Of course, alcohol after prohibition in the United States is the sanctioned drug of choice, and it's always the idea of a party, you get alcohol, and celebrations of champagne. Well, marijuana at a time was the drug of choice for the young people, particularly the college set. Well, it certainly has expanded, and being clinically aware of young people's indulgences, I know that it has gone far from marijuana now. Cocaine was big among the rich set, and then there's crack cocaine for the poor set, and unfortunately there was crystal meth and just a bevy of pain-relieving medications that got into the street and became some kind of play medication. There were the psychotropics where you hallucinated. There was ecstasy, which is supposed to make you sex-crazed, and all kinds of things that was amnestic, and unfortunately date rape and other things occurred. What all of those things have in common, they affect the brain. Now, the well-being or the confidence some report with the sniffing of cocaine, and even those who inject heroin report just an absolute feeling of control, and some would say for the first time confidence. Well, the reason they're experiencing these things from extrogenous or outside components is that their receptors on the brain react to those components they're introducing. Well, you don't have to go out and get recreational drugs to get stimulation to the brain. And now that they're establishing, for instance, the long-distance runner, the marathon runner, the any athlete of any caliber will tell you that when they are at the absolute maximum of their performance, and I choose marathon runners because that's usually a six, sometime an eight-hour race because you're running 26 miles, the body has a certain level of endurance, and many of them will talk about running and feeling fine the first 2, 3, 4 hours, and then they hit a wall. And what they mean is the body may feel like legs want to cramp up, they can't take a deep enough breath for the oxygen they feel they need, they may feel a little nauseated, and then after perhaps 60, 90 seconds, that goes away. And instead, they have this sense of invincibility, this euphoria. And this transition of feeling when this athlete is really exerting has been associated with the release of a hormone called endorphins. And endorphins are made inside the gut, it's made in the liver. And when it's released, the brain reacts to it in this wonderful way that suddenly fatigue is no longer there, a sense of dread is no longer there, the muscles respond because they too have some receptors, and the person who has what they call the second wind is generally a person who has rehearsed and practiced and gotten themselves conditioned so well that their body is trained to supplement. That when they get to the point of hitting the wall, their natural supply of endorphins and others, there's serotonin, there's dopamine, there's a whole bevy of what we call neuropeptides that can stimulate performance. And if you ever heard with the Olympics and others, they talk about performance-enhancing drugs, what they found that a man can make compounds like endorphins, I think morphine and heroin are two drugs that they say simulate a lot of what the endorphins do. But there are others that young men who are bodybuilding and who need to have gymnastic abilities, who want more flexibility, or who want a greater strength and muscle tissue, have been known to use certain enhancing medications. And essentially what they're saying is they're taking an extrogenous peptide that stimulates a specific area. If it's the muscle they want to work, if they want larger biceps or triceps or whatever the muscle groups they're working with, they want to jump higher and they want greater quads, they can target it physiologically. And in competitions like the Olympics, they've ruled that that kind of enhancement is illegal. Now, what are the incentives medically for even looking at those have to do with military? There's always that idea, can we make that extra special soldier? You know, can he run faster? Can he lift more? Can he climb? Can he go without food longer and so forth and so on? So the motivation of the perfect soldier, of course, the deprivations of war, all contribute, I don't know if you say fortunately or unfortunately, to some of the advancements in medical human physiology advancements. Back on topic, you make me sick. Let's talk about that. Well, just an example I used with war. There was a study done, and it's not a pleasant thought, but certainly it's true, that young men who were in the military, we're talking 17 to 24-year-olds, who went to war, and when they came out of war because of injury, a lot of the physicians who was caring for them made a note that many of these young people, unfortunately, had advanced ulcerations in the stomach. And for those who may have died young due to the trauma of war, they found that there was premature hardening of arteries. And when you looked at the age range, we usually associated these conditions with post-40-year-olds, and perhaps we would have attributed some of those conditions to environmental, like smoking or use of alcohol and so forth. And seeing it in a young person where you would expect pristine vessels or healthy gastric lining, they had to conclude that the extreme stress that these young men had been under had contributed to these physiologic changes. In other words, their stress, their anxiety, the unusual emotional complexities that they were facing had contributed to what we might call pathologies expected in much older people or people with very serious health problems. So, if we know that the neuropeptides can be associated with mood changes, when we talk about endorphins that we just talked about for the happy hormone that may be referred to, we know that insulin that controls blood sugar is hormonal, vasopressin, which controls blood pressure, is hormonal. Certainly sex hormone and sex drive we know is affected by emotion. If you're in an amorous situation and you're surprised, somehow the moment is lost, as the phrasing goes. So we are aware of such things contributing to adverse circumstances, and yet we seldom make a point of looking at the scientific reasoning behind it. So we do know it. We know it instinctively. We know it by experience, and yet no one really says it outright until now. So now with the conversation of today, you know that if you're in a relationship where you are unhappy, it can make you sick. If you are in a job where you are pretending or trying to hold on, it can make you sick. And the next question is, how sick can it make you? Well, what has been proven in the studies that I've just talked about, the very peptides that we know can stimulate receptors in our brain, in the stomach wall, in the gut wall, in our vessel wall, when there is a chronic release of a hormone that is negative, and negative can just be interpreted as something that is in excess of what should be. So if you have too much insulin, and insulin is a good thing for health, but too much insulin, you go into a coma and you can die. So if you're in a situation where, let's use cortisol, and you have a high amount of cortisol, you're at high risk, first of all, for abdominal obesity. They've certainly linked that one very well. Secondarily, you're at risk for all kinds of irritable bowel syndrome, where you can have diarrhea or you can have severe constipation. So the excess of cortisol has been demonstrated, mostly because they wanted to commercialize anti-cortisol anti-obesity types of income. So the changes that can result from an excess of a peptide is generally changes in your immune system. And there is a wave of study now that attributes all types of conditions to what they're calling inflammatory situations. They're saying atherosclerosis, which gives rise, of course, to hypertension and to heart attacks, start with an inflamed lining of your vessel. They're saying diabetes, which we usually think about as just elevated glucose, now has been defined as a whole syndrome. It affects the wall of vessels. It affects how we break down our fats or not. It affects how our red blood cells live, how long it lives and circulates. It has a large impact on anybody, whether it's type 1 or type 2. And the presence of insulin, whether it's being used appropriately, uptaking glucose and feeding our cells, or if it's circulating in excess, it certainly contributes to what they're now calling an inflammatory syndrome. And if we keep talking about inflammatory, that makes you have to wonder, is it the immune system that's controlling everything? Well, I can't answer that, but I know it's been implicated in almost everything. If you talk about arthritis, that's autoimmune disease, which means immune system attacking healthy something. If we talk about multiple sclerosis, that is an autoimmune situation. And we can list lupus and so many other conditions where they say autoimmune, and it's simply saying the immune system is not functioning within the realm of normalcy, and the consequences are just a myriad of diseases. So if we now have something called neuropeptides that can adversely affect any organ in the body, and certainly disturb the immune system, then we can say with scientific proof that your emotions do control your health. Wow. All of that study, all of that training, and it comes right back to something, and I like referring to my training. When I was a child, I can remember my mother would come into a room if someone were ill. And to me at the time, it sounded and seemed a bit cruel. And now I look at it and say, wow, she was genius. She would say, get up off your sick bed. And literally, that's what she meant. If it meant taking a blanket and wrapping it around your shoulders because there was no house coat, or putting something where you would be moved from the bed onto a chair. And if you sat on that chair no more than 2 or 3 minutes, you were taken up off of your sick bed. The bed would be, if you couldn't freshen the sheets or do laundry, because we did not have automatic washers and dryers in our house, she would take powder. We would call it baby powder. I guess it's Johnson & Johnson's powder. And she'd sprinkle it on the sheets, and she'd rub it over the sheets, and she'd sprinkle it inside of a pillowcase and pluff it up and freshen. This was the concept of freshening the sick bed. And then pulling the sheets tight and tucking corners and whatever. And if you were strong enough, you would be advised to go and wash your face and rinse your mouth, even if you didn't brush your teeth. And I suspect if you were sweaty or you soiled yourself, you'd get fresh pajamas, even if you did not have a chance to bathe, because we didn't have a shower in our house. We actually, as they call it, you did sponge bathing, unless you sat down in a tin tub and bathed. So her concept, get up off the sick bed, freshen it, change the environment. She would open windows or open drapes. It was an effort to take the emotion to another level, that if you couldn't feel well, healthy, you could certainly smell a new fresh scent, which was the baby powder. You could change your position from laying down by sitting in a chair. You could get fresh bedclothes just to change the general, as we would say, milieu of the environment. And now we're coming to understand, if you look at the commercials that they do about cancer and cancer centers, they talk about having a team, and the team works on every aspect. You have a spiritual leader who helps you to think positive, and you can have aromatherapy where you smell fragrances like lilac You're served things like chamomile tea, which can calm the spirit. You may give massages or receive a massage. You may have hot tub experiences. You may have walks through the park. Your food is addressed, how the food is prepared, whether it's a cool food or a hot food. The whole concept we would call holistic medicine. But the intent is to let the mind and the body work together to promote a healthiness. And the converse of that is if you harbor anger, bitterness, resentment, fear, chronic worry, then you are triggering stress responses within your body. And these responses can cause the release of peptides, neuropeptides, hormones, whatever terminology you want to use. And when these peptides are released in quantities other than what we call homeostasis or normal, then you can start having reactions that correspond to that pathology or excess. And there are those who say you get stomach ulcers, migraine headaches, general fatigue, muscle aches, obesity. Some would say you can even bring on cancer, autoimmune conditions because of a very unhappy or emotionally stressed situation. So stress and depression can suppress the activities of white blood cells, which are your immune system cells. And without them, you do not have that first line of defense. So if you're compromising your immune system with an overactive production of peptides coming from stress, and keep in mind that stress can be from an external source or an internal source. If you are always worried, if you are harboring anger, if you're resentful, then you can be generating an internal stress that can give rise to cancer and make you susceptible to infections that others could possibly not, who are less stressed. We know that the cells in the immune system are responsive to over 90 neuropeptides. In other words, what I emit when I'm stressed may be different from what you emit when you're stressed. So how I handle stress may be very different from how you handle stress. And that's what I emphasize when in my clinical practice when people would say, well, what do you do or what do you take or what do you... It is very difficult, and unfortunately in Western medicine we tend to do conditions and not people. That high blood pressure, we treat high blood pressure. We should be treating the person with high blood pressure. So if you tend to be a worrier and you require going outside and working in your garden or taking a walk or jogging around the block, that's what you need to do. If when I get stressed, I need to soak in a hot tub and light some candles and smell a nice fragrance, that's what I need to do. So you need to be true to yourself. You can't mimic what someone else does. You can't take their release and apply it necessarily to your life. I know a lot of very successful people, and I hear some say, well, I don't sleep much. Well, there was a time when I survived very comfortably on 4 hours a day. And during that time, I was doing a lot of things, and my life was full, and my energy was high, and at times I can still do that. But I don't try to do that anymore. It's not necessary. And I find other ways to meet my needs and not have sleep deprivation. Now, when I still talk to people who tell me they're doing 4 hours a night, I say, well, great. That's wonderful. And they say, well, weren't you one who could do the same? I said, yes, probably still can, but I don't. It's not necessary. I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm not trying to impress anyone. So you have to come to terms with what's best for you. One of the things that you will hear a lot, at least I do, how in Americans, when they're really go-getters, a lot of the husbands will work long hours and miss seeing their children grow up. Now, if you're putting in a 12, 15-hour day and you have a child under the age of 5, you're missing their life. If you skip vacation because you're afraid someone else may do something in the office while you are away and consequently you're accumulating your sick days and accumulating your vacation days and your family is not having a chance to enjoy you in a relaxed state, you're really hurting yourself. So when you talk about the high incidence or you look around, there's a high incidence of breast cancer in women. I've had people say, what do you think that's all about, Dr. Bowles? And I said, well, I'll track it back to when women became ERA equals. We suddenly were doing the same job as men and doing going out into the world and into a plant. And what we didn't seem to have built into the formula is what happens at home while you're out doing what everybody else, usually men, are doing. The unfortunate thing is you come home and you resume that other identity. And some women did it flawlessly. Some absolutely did not. That you're fatigued after working in an office setting. You've met new stresses. You're in different category. You come home, and now you have to put on that empathetic self, and you have to be more forbearing. And if the children are young, you have to have some patience, and you have to be in a mode of training, and you have to be in a mode of sacrifice. And that transition, I think, has taken a toll on many women. Does not say they don't execute. They bring home the bacon and they fry it and feed it. But they're having breast cancer. And they're having reflux. I look at the commercials on how many commercials we have on acid reflux and advertisements for Nexium, the purple pill, like that's a normal thing. Or Tums, how quick it works, and it works faster than Zantac. The irony and the sadness is that we even need that at all. There was no need for such commercials in the past. Mom might say take a little baking soda if you had some problem, but basically the lives we lived and the foods we ate didn't require acid neutralization. So there's consequences. There's consequences. And by scientific research, we now know your emotion is a very real component in your state of health. So if you are trying to get things right in 2015 and you're uncluttering your life with things and you're taking time to reflect on yourself, then I also ask you to be aware of your environmental, emotional health. Are you doing the things that allow you to be the best person you can? Are you looking after yourself first, so that you can then help those around you? It really is true that you make me sick, because how you feel is real and the body is listening, and I advise that you do the same. With that, I thank you so much for listening, and until next time, be safe.